This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Edmund White, has been chronicling gay culture since the 1970s. He's the author of 17 books, including the autobiographical novels A Boy's Own Story, The Beautiful Room is Empty, and The Farewell Symphony. The series begins with a character growing up gay and confused, trying to become straight. The trilogy concludes with the death of a lover from AIDS. White won a National Book Critics Circle Award for his biography of the writer Jean Genet. White now directs the creative writing program at Princeton University. His new book, Arts and Letters, is a collection of essays about writers and artists, including Oscar Wilde, Allen Ginsberg, James Baldwin, Vladimir Nabokov, Marcel Duchamp, and Andy Warhol. The book opens with a personal essay called Writing Gay. In 1983, White moved to Paris, where he stayed for the next 16 years. He now lives in New York City. I asked him about his reaction to the movement to ban gay marriage.
Well, I mean, I guess since I lived in France for so many years, where the law went through rather easily for civil unions, I can't help but be struck by the difference. And I think the main difference is that America is so religious. I mean, France is theoretically Catholic, but the people, I think, could best be described as Catholic atheists. But I think that what the French discovered is that when they originally proposed the pacts, which was their word for the civil unions, as a strictly gay thing, it got rejected. But then they rethought it and they said, all right, we'll propose this as a union between any two people who've lived together for at least 3 years and who share their lives. And it can be mothers and daughters or brother and sister or straight couple or a gay couple. And that went through perfectly. So I think it was very well calibrated to the French national character, which is one that honors the abstract individual and believes in universalism. Whereas I think in America, the real problem, I mean, what's interesting is that the statistics in America show that a large percentage of Americans accept the idea of equal rights and things like visitation rights in hospitals, being able to maybe get tax benefits that a couple might enjoy. But what they really reject is the idea of a church wedding. It's the sacred aspect, which, I mean, and in a way they have a point. It does run counter to a lot of the Bible, which is really hostile to homosexuality.
Would you be supportive of legislation in America similar to what was passed in France that would open the idea of civil unions to any two people who have lived together a certain requisite amount of time?
Yeah, I think it's a very intelligent approach to the problem because I think the problem with any legislation that gays are campaigning for is that there's so few gays. I mean, I think my own feeling is that probably only about 3% of the population would really declare itself to be lesbian or gay. I mean, many more people have had homosexual experiences, but they don't define themselves as gay. But so I think it's important to pick up other allies, and I think there are an awful lot of young couples who are living together, straight or gay, and older couples. I mean, all kinds of people, or as in France, mothers and daughters. I mean, people who are basically sharing their lives and who want to share all the legal benefits of any normal couple.
Are you surprised that so many gay and lesbian couples want to get married? I mean, when you came out in the 70s, there was really a debate over whether, you know, marriage was something gay people even wanted. Was gay life going to be such a total reexamination of the nature of relationships and social rules and everything that marriage wouldn't even be in the picture even if you could have it?
Well, I think a lot changed since the 70s. I think that most of the visible and vocal gay spokespeople in the 70s were leftists. And they were the only ones who were really willing to come out and who felt that gay life was part of the great spectrum of progressive leftist causes. Then I think what happened is in the 80s, AIDS brought out of the closet, forced out of the closet, many people on the right, many established, well-to-do people. And you get the phenomenon of the log cabin Republican, that is, these gay Republicans. And since they were establishment people, they sort of took over. And the whole movement got taken over and dragged to the right and toward the goal of assimilation. I mean, my generation, I'm 64, and my generation of gays in the 60s and 70s was definitely felt very revolutionary. And I think gay liberation began under the aegis of similar movements like women's liberation and black liberation, but and the Vietnam War protests. That was all that era, and gay liberation began in 69 at the height of that those protest movements. But as I say, in the 80s with the advent of AIDS, I think the whole thing shifted to the right, and a kind of special destiny for gays was dropped in favor of an idea of assimilation.
Well, maybe being gay is just less radical than you used to think. Do you know what I mean? Maybe there's a complete political spectrum of gay people just as there is with straight people. And it's not necessarily a kind of, you know, counterculture or alternative culture type of thing.
Exactly. Well, I think that's absolutely right. And I think that even a lot of the counterculture people in general, straight or gay, are floundering now. They don't quite know what to do with themselves or what their constituency or program might be.
You know, you write in your new book that you think the ardor and zeal that gay people are bringing to marriage may actually renew the prestige of the institution of marriage, even in the eyes of straight people. I'm going to ask you to elaborate on that.
I mean, I do think that people who belong to minority groups oftentimes crave the legitimizing of the establishment. I mean, I wrote a little biography of Marcel Proust, for instance, and everybody wondered at the time of his life why he was so eager to get the Legion of Honor from the French government. It seemed like here he was this genius. What need could he possibly have of some tacky award that every neighborhood butcher can get in France? But he absolutely wanted it. And I think it's perfectly clear. He was somebody who was half Jewish, entirely gay, and really felt excluded from French society, though he was revered by literary people. And I think he wanted that legitimizing thing. And I think it's very similar to many lesbians and gays, that they really crave having the society at large say, yes, you're okay, you're like everyone else, and yes, you can adopt, and yes, you can have normal families. And I think we need that more than straight people do.
Did you ever want to get married?
I never did. I was engaged to two different women when I was younger and struggling to go straight. And again, I think that was this kind of almost magical idea that people have about marriage, that it will transform you, that you will become somebody else. And I think the tragedy of marriage is that you don't become somebody else, that you stay the same old person with the same old problems. And maybe even with the new fears that, oh my God, I'm going to be in this for the rest of my life once you're married. But in terms of gay life, no, I never, it always seemed to me that what was attractive about gay life for me was that it expressed a lot of freedom from basic cultural institutions, that it was the sort of the rebel's way. And I always liked the kind of wild boy, run with the pack, stay up all night, be close to almost a juvenile delinquent. That aspect of gay life, that sort of adolescent boy aspect of gay life, always appealed to me immensely.
Because you've chronicled gay culture for several decades now, I'm curious to see where you think gay culture is now, both in terms of the impact it's having on popular culture and in terms of the degree of homophobia it faces now.
Well, I think that there's a curious bifurcation even in the minds of fairly conservative people, that if they know gays, they tend to like them as individuals or not like them, but anyway, to treat them exactly as they would anybody else, and they see them as human beings. And I think part of the humanizing effect has come from the fact that many gay people have come out, so they're identified and identifiable. And it has come from shows like Will and Grace and Queer Eye for Straight Guy and all these programs, which I think have, whatever we might think of their politics, nevertheless, they've made gay men and to some degree lesbians seem like part of everyday life. And so all that has sort of warmed people up at the same time that various Christian religions, and Muslim for that matter, and Jewish too, have preached against homosexuality. So it seems to me that there's this sort of strange schizophrenia in America. And I do think that it's a very depressing moment for gays. And I think that my main feeling, and it sounds childish to say it, is I feel hurt. I feel hurt that my country, or at least so many of my fellow countrymen and women, have rejected me. I feel it on a very personal level. And I think many, many gay people do. I had dinner with a group of gay guys last night, and we all sort of felt like taking our toys and leaving the playground and going away someplace else. I mean, people talk about moving to Canada or going to France or doing different things. And I think there's this real feeling that for years and years and years, there was a slow but steady progress that was being made in terms of acceptance and visibility. But now I think we see that even though gays are very visible, more so than they've ever been, it hasn't really led to acceptance, not in a generic or legal way.
My guest is writer Edmund White. Since the 1970s, he's chronicled gay life in his works of fiction and nonfiction. His new book is a collection of essays about artists and writers called Arts and Letters. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Ed White, and he is the author of many books chronicling gay life, gay culture. He's written fiction, memoir, biography, and his new book is a collection of essays called Arts and Letters. He directs the creative writing program at Princeton University. You lived in Paris for, was it about 16 years?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you moved back to the States 4 years ago. You say in one of your essays in your new book that when you came back to the United States 4 years ago, you were surprised by several things. Those things include the institutionalization of identity politics, the rise of political correctness, and the growth of Oprah-style programs and the memoir industry. Let's start with the institutionalization of identity politics. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that in the 60s and 70s, there still were broad coalitions of people on the left, and people weren't really campaigning full-time about a single issue. I mean, I think one of the maybe tremendous – well, I don't know really what I think about this, but let me just propose this for a second. Maybe gays should have insisted that the gay marriage idea be withdrawn now in the interest of a large coalition on the left. I mean, in other words, if we can't have a Democratic president, then we're all in trouble. And in fact, that's what happened. And if the gay marriage issue was, as people are claiming, actually one of the main reasons why Bush won, then maybe it would have been much better tactics to withdraw the gay marriage issue altogether at this time. But would a group of gay activists be able to do that? Would they be able to put their own interests aside for a moment in the interest of a large leftist or progressive or coalition? And I don't think so. And then again, there's another part of me that says, well, wait a minute, would you dare say to blacks, okay, well, let's put aside your longings for equality in the job world or in the courts. Please put that aside for the next 4 or 8 years while we sort other things out. We wouldn't dare ask them to do that, and we would certainly feel that there was something strange if they were willing to do that. So I don't really know why gays should sacrifice their interests in the interest of a larger cause. So you can see I'm debating this back and forth in my own mind. Mm-hmm, I don't quite mm-hmm. know what I think about it. But it did seem to me that it was very bad tactics at this to have brought up gay marriage as a leading salient issue at this time.
Another thing that surprised you when we returned to America from France was the growth of the Oprah-style programs and the memoir industry.
Well, I think they go together. And I think that memoirs, when I was young, were written by the general who won the Battle of Iwo Jima, or General Eisenhower, somebody who was already established as an important person. And then at the end of his, usually his life, but her life sometimes, he or she would write a memoir that would sort of trace out the facts of this already inherently interesting life. But in my day, nobodies did never wrote memoirs. Nobody wanted to read the memoir of a nobody. But then by the time I came, and so when I, for instance, wrote about my early life in a novel called A Boy's Own Story, I was very careful to call it a novel and to bring to it all of the traditional means for involving the reader and instilling some interest in my life in the reader that would be used by a novelist. I mean, it was clearly a novel with all the novel's traditional strategies. But then by the time I came back at the end of the 90s, all that had been replaced by memoirs, and people would now write memoirs about a disability or about a dreadful childhood they had had, or about belonging to a minority group or something like that. So in other words, it was all sort of part of the culture of complaint, I suppose, that and the Oprah-style program where people also got on and talked about their abuse as children and so on, that was all new. And what's interesting is that, I mean, just to give you a tiny example from my own life, when I published Boy's Own Story in 1983, though it contained a lot of very personal information about my own life, people who interviewed me would never have dreamed of asking me a personal question. They were always very careful to say, the protagonist in your novel, the first person narrator in your novel goes through such, and then I would say, yes, he does. And there would never be a moment where I'd say, yes, I did, or I do that. So it was all kept in a kind of distant, impersonal level of discourse. Now, of course, everybody skips that. And even if you claim that your book is a novel, people are quick to ignore that and just go for the jugular and ask the most personal questions imaginable.
You've written several autobiographical novels that many people, I think, even confuse with memoir because they're fiction, but they shadow your life in some way, even though the character isn't you. You're now writing a for-real memoir. You have an introductory essay in your new book, Arts and Letters, about writing gay. And you talk about how, I think it's in this essay, you talk about how when you started to write, writing was almost like therapy for you. You had to write. You had to get out the anger that you felt and the feelings of alienation. And so it was part therapy and part just that you were a writer. Why, at this point in your life, have you decided to write a memoir and to not mix your life, you know, to refashion your life into fiction?
Right. Well, I guess having written that trilogy, Boy's Own Story, Beautiful Room is Empty, and The Farewell Symphony, I feel like that is a sort of self-contained unit that I thought, well, it'd be interesting to cover all kinds of things that I never even mentioned in those books and to present them in an entirely different way formally. So, first of all, it is the truth as best as I can establish it, whereas I took many liberties with the truth and especially with chronology in the fictional trilogy. Because in those those novels, I was always trying to design a good novel. So I would, if there had been five lovers, I'd reduce it to two. If there had been, if I'd been in a place for 7 years, I might make it 1 year. In other words, I was always trying to condense and simplify the actual facts of my life to make them more coherent artistically. Whereas in this book, which is called My Lives, I decided to cut the pie in a very different way and to organize it not chronologically, but thematically. So there's a chapter called My Shrinks, for instance, in which I just talk about the five shrinks that I saw over a 25-year period. And it's, I hope, quite a funny essay. And there are other ones where I we'll talk about my hustlers, for instance, because even when I was 16 years old, I began to hire hustlers. I was always fascinated by hustlers. And And so I give a whole long look at that. When I first started doing it, I was so young that people were the hustlers were oftentimes older than me and very shocked that anybody so young would want to hire them. And then later, of course, I became more the ordinary age for hiring hustlers. And it's always been a very minor part of my life, but a constant part. And it's something I found interesting to write about. I still leave an awful lot out. Like, I don't talk about my teaching. I don't really talk about my friendships, although friendship has probably been the main theme of my life. But I somehow worried about writing about my friends because I felt like either people would feel I was saying too much about them, or I was dropping their names in ways that they didn't like, or I wasn't including them and they'd be hurt. But I thought, this is such a mess. I'm just going to stay out of it. And also, my friends are really more valuable to me than my books are. So I thought, to hell with it. I'm just going to preserve that as my own private domain.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry. It's great to talk to you again.
Edmund White directs the creative writing program at Princeton University. His new book is a collection of essays about writers and artists called Arts and Letters. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.